Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, November 27, 2017, during a live Courthouse Steps teleform conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Practice Group's teleform conference call, as today we discuss the oral argument in the Oil State versus Greens Energy Group case, also known as the Patent Trial Advisory Board case. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome to our call today two experts, both of whom attended oral argument. They're going to give us their reports. We'll hear first from Mr. Brian H. Pandya. He's a partner at Wiley Ryan. And we'll hear second from Mr. Matthew J. Dowd. He's the founder of Dowd PLLC right here in Washington, D.C. As I mentioned, they both attended oral arguments, and I'm excited to hear what transpired at what I used to call the sleeper case of the term, but it's getting so much prominence and coverage now that might no longer be the case, that it's a sleeper case. But with that, opening remarks of 5 to 10 minutes from each of our guests. Brian Pandya, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean, for that kind introduction, and thank you for asking us to do today's teleforum. Again, this is Brian Pandya. I'm a partner at Wiley Ryan, and I just want to reiterate that anything I say here is my personal observations of today's argument, and of course not reflective of any the firm's views or any views of our clients. But with that standard disclaimer, Dean, you called this case one of the sleeper cases, but today's argument was anything but sleepy. I've in fact never seen anything like this before in a patent case, from protesters outside the court lamenting the Patent Trial and Appeal Board to a line to get into the courtroom that's more typical of a case dealing with a social hot-button issue to the intensity of the questioning. I have attended several arguments before at the Supreme Court involving patent cases, and typically IP cases are viewed in the same way as the court views bankruptcy or tax or civil procedure cases, cases that are very challenging, very intricate cases, but not cases that inflame passions. At least in Oil States, this was one of the most animated and engaged benches that I have seen at the Supreme Court in an IP case. The question presented by the petitioner in Oil States was quite sweeping, and the question presented was, quote, whether inter-parties review, an adversarial process used by the Patent and Trademark Office to analyze the validity of existing patents, violates the Constitution by extinguishing private property rights through a non-Article III forum without a jury. Today's oral argument, though, was much more narrowly focused and, intensely focused on where to draw the line on what the Patent Office or what the Patent Trial and Appeal Board can constitutionally do. There was no talk of the Seventh Amendment and a right to jury trials. There was surprisingly little discussion of the meta question that drives this dispute over whether a patent is private property or a public right. Now, Allison Ho, who argued for the petitioner, I thought did a nice job at teeing up the issues and made a concession early in the argument that I thought was strategically and tactically very savvy and framed the argument. Now, her five main points, Oil State's five main points, were, number one, whether the PTAB exercises judicial powers. Number two, that IPRs are disputes between private parties. Number three, IPRs are disputes involving private rights. Number four, there is insufficient Article III supervision of the PTAB. And number five, for 400 years, courts, not agencies, have adjudicated patent invalidity. And for those reasons, Oil States argues that the PTAB process is constitutionally infirm. Now, the first question of the day came from Justice Ginsburg, who asked if the PTO has any error correction mechanism. That is, can the Patent and Trademark Office decide to call back or cancel a patent that it later decides was not properly issued? And the answer that Oil States Counsel gave, I thought, was a clever answer, and The answer was whether a proceeding is more adjudicatory, which is what Oil States contends the PTAB proceedings are, or whether it's an examinational proceeding, which is like ex parte re-examination, which is something that has existed at the patent office for a long time. It's a way that a member of the public can petition the patent office to take a second look at the at a patent. Now, something like ex parte re-exam, where the patent examiner drives the process, would be okay, oil states conceded, but something like an inter-parties review, which is called a trial, is not okay. And that drove a lot of the questioning about where to draw the line. And I, looking back at my notes here, counted there were several. There was a question early on from Justice Sotomayor about whether whether an IPR is an adjudicatory proceeding or an examinational proceeding, and whether who has the burden of production, whether it's the petitioner or, in the case of inter-parties reviews, or whether it's the patent examiner or the patent office in the case of ex parte reviews, whether that matters. There was another question from Justice Ginsburg about how narrow are IPR proceedings. Justice Ginsburg pointed out that the PTAB cannot decide infringement. It's narrow, it's limited to only looking at prior art, which is the same thing, one of the things the patent office looks at when deciding whether to issue a patent. There was a question from Justice Kagan, actually two questions, one of whether the government was, quote, in effect, just trying to figure out whether it made a mistake in issuing a patent, and the fact that there's a petitioner or a private party driving the proceeding was just a proxy for the government doing what it had always done in the past, or at least had done for 40 years before, in ex parte re-examination, in more recently in inter partes re-examination proceedings. There was another question from Justice Kagan about how to ground the issues here. How do we frame the dispute? I think there was no one on the court, except maybe one justice, that would say that the patent office has no right or no ability to cancel or revoke a patent that it issued. On the other hand, I think all of the justices that asked questions today had some degree of questions about whether a patent that, as Justice Breyer said during the respondent's argument, whether a patent that's been enforced for 10 years has been the subject of significant capital investments by the patent owner, whether there is some expectation that the patent will remain in force, notwithstanding a finding in court that the patent is invalid. Another interesting line of questions today came, and this was a question that was asked of counsel for oil states, counsel for Greens Energy Group, and the attorney from the Solicitor General's office who argued the case today, whether there's a congressional fix that could be made, whether Congress could condition the grant of patents on consenting to being subject to inter-parties review at the Patent Trial and Appeal Board. There were a number of different variations on that question, a number of different answers, but that seemed to be a question that both Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kennedy asked, whether there was some type of fix that could be put into place by Congress to make these proceedings comply with Article III. There were other variations on that question about whether this is something that Congress could fix, whether pre-America Invents Act patents perhaps were not subject to an expectation that they could be called into question at the Patent Trial and Appeal Board. However, patents issued, or at least issued from applications filed after the America Invents Act, maybe there was a reasonable expectation that they can be challenged at the PTAB, and there's an expectation that if you have a patent, you could always be called back into the PTAB for further consideration. Two other questions that I thought were going to get a little bit more play at the court, but did not for whatever reason. One question dealt with the McCormick case, which is a 19th century case where, depending how you read the case, the petitioner's oil state would like you to believe that the court made a constitutional decision that the Patent Office does not have the right to cancel a patent to take property. The respondents take the view on the McCormick case that there was just a lack of statutory authority in the 19th century that allowed the Patent Office at that time to take a patent. One other question that I thought was interesting came from Justice Gorsuch. She made a number of analogies to land patents and whether there is an analogy to be drawn between patents on an invention and the grant of a land patent. So the argument certainly was very animated, very engaged by all the justices that asked questions. I would hesitate to ever make a prediction on how the Supreme Court is going to rule in a case. However, I will say that this summer, Joseph Mittal, who's the interim director of the Patent Office, boldly predicted at a conference that this case was going to be a 9-0 win for respondents and for the Patent Office. I don't see that happening. Now, whether it's a 5-4, 6-3 case, I do think that this will not be a unanimous case or even an 8-1 case based on some of the questioning that we heard today. And certainly this is a difficult case for the court to decide, and I think some of the questions today reflected their difficulty with, on one hand, I think they all seem to agree that the Patent Office should be able to correct mistakes that they made. On the other hand, I think they were a little bit troubled by some aspects of inter partes review at the Patent Trial and Appeal Board, whether it be the limited supervision, the limited appealability of PTAB decisions to an Article III court, and some other characteristics of what happens at the Patent Trial and Appeal Board. So with that, I will turn it over to Matt and to give his take on the SAS case.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks very much. This is Matthew Dowd, Dowd PLLC. Thanks for having me join you today for a briefing about the arguments, two biggest patent cases of this term. The case I am talking about is captioned SAS Institute versus Mittal. And before I get into the particular legal issue, I would like to give a little factual background of the patent dispute that's involved, because I think it helps frame the issue and understand the actual statutory issue that was being discussed today in the court. SAS Institute, back in 2012, was sued for patent infringement by a company called ComplimentSoft, and they are the owner of the 936 patent. And in ComplimentSoft's patent are 16 claims. And when ComplimentSoft first sued SAS Institute, they sued based on several but did not recite all of the claims. In response, SAS Institute then went to the Patent Office to file a petition for inter partes review. And in that petition for review, SAS asked for review of all 16 claims that are in ComplimentSoft's patent. The board, about 5 months later, and this is the PTAB, or otherwise known as the board, which I will call the board, granted review of the patent. So it instituted the IPR proceeding, but it did not institute review of all 16 claims. Rather, it instituted review of only claims 1 and 3 through 10, so leaving claims 2 and 11 through 16 untouched by the board's review. About a year after the patent board instituted review, the parties proceeded through the inter partes review process, and this entire process is what was subject to the Oil States case that Brian was just discussing. And one of the goals of IPR review is to provide a less expensive, more efficient, and faster proceeding to challenge the validity of a patent and patent claims. And that is what SAS Institute did. Unfortunately for SAS Institute, the board did not institute review of all the claims. In the board's final written decision, the board, again, ruled on the validity of some but not all of the challenged claims. And SAS then appealed to the Federal Circuit. And essentially what SAS's argument is that the board must institute review, or it must provide a final written decision on all of the claims that are actually challenged by a patent challenger in the IPR process. And that issue, as framed, is the precise question presented to the court today, and that's a question of statutory construction. And the particular statute is 35 U.S.C. Section 318A. And I will just read part of it in the relevant part so we understand exactly what was being discussed at the court today. And 318A provides that if an inter partes review is instituted and not dismissed, the Patent Trial and Appeal Board shall issue a final written decision with respect to the patentability of any patent claim challenged by the petitioner and any new claim added under Section 316D. So the relevant and operative phrase that was being disputed today was the four words, any patent claim challenged. The Patent Board has instituted or promulgated rules that interpret this process, and the way the Patent Office has interpreted this is that the phrase any patent claim challenged refers only to the claims that are instituted for review after the initial decision by the board. SAS Institute, of course, takes a different view and reads the statute as being plain on its face. And I think that there is some merit to that argument. It says any patent claim challenged by the petitioner. And if you read those words in that statute, and perhaps in isolation, then I think the natural reading of this phrase is referring to whatever claims are challenged in the petition that's actually filed to institute review, and not necessarily to the claims that are actually chosen to be reviewed by the board. Now, one question is, why does any of this matter? In many respects, right, a patent challenger might not want to have a final written decision from the board that's actually affirming the validity of the challenged claims. And if your client or you are the patent challenger, you may prefer that the claims not be decided in a final written decision, because that could give you the opportunity to continue to challenge them through the district court proceeding. And so with respect to that ultimate question of why bother having a final written decision on all the claims challenged, that was really one of the first sets of questions that was asked during oral argument today. And Justice Sotomayor really cut to the chase. And her first sets of questions, even before the attorney for the petitioner, Greg Castanis, could get out his three initial points, was asking Mr. Castanis, well, why do you want to get a final written decision? And Justice Sotomayor really hit the nail on the head, at least part of it, is that without a final written decision on those claims that were challenged, there's no way to appeal the ruling. And what SAS Institute wants here is an ability to appeal that decision to the Federal Circuit. And that's only possible if there's a ruling on the merits in the final written decision. And Justice Sotomayor reminded everyone in the court that, despite her differing opinion in the Cuozzo case, that the precedent from Cuozzo was that a party cannot challenge the institution or non-institution of a petition for IPR. And bringing us back to that case just for a moment, you will likely recall that Justice Breyer was the lead author on the opinion for Cuozzo. And one of the holdings in Cuozzo is basically that the institution decision that the board makes, namely the decision whether to proceed to a full quote-unquote trial in the IPR, is non-appealable per statute. And once you get past that decision, then you get ultimately to a final written decision from the board, assuming that the case is not dismissed or settled prior to a final decision. And then only that final written decision is appealable to the Federal Circuit and then ultimately to the Supreme Court. So now, stepping back just for 1 second and parsing out the arguments and the different issues that were discussed by the attorneys today and by the justices, as an initial assessment, a lot of the discussion focused on statutory analysis because, as I hinted at earlier, the case can be considered or could be viewed as a relatively straightforward statutory interpretation case. It's looking at what the meaning of Section 318A is, and in particular, those four words of what, quote-unquote, any patent claim challenged means. As I said, the petitioner takes that to read just on its face that that means any claim challenged and raised as a potential challenge in the opening petition filed by the petitioner. Now, the government, on the other hand, takes a more holistic interpretation of that phrase and of the statute. And I will say that I think the government's attorney, the Solicitor General's office, attorney Jonathan Bond, did an excellent job of arguing today. And he really emphasized the fact that that you cannot read that phrase of 318A in isolation. The only way to properly understand that text, that statutory text, is to read it in the context of both the that entire section and also the entire AIA and the purpose of what Congress authorized the Patent Office to do and not to do. Now, sticking with the statutory text analysis, I thought one surprising comment which led into a question was from Justice Breyer. As I said, Justice Breyer wrote the Cuozzo opinion for the court. Justice Sotomayor early on was identifying that, well, maybe this case, SAS Institute, is just trying to get a workaround of how to get out of from underneath Cuozzo. But Justice Breyer was quite forthright, saying that he thought the statutory text of 318A, in fact, helped the petitioners in this case. Now, as you all know, Justice Breyer is often not limited solely to the statutory text when he undertakes a statutory construction argument or a case. So he certainly asked many questions that went beyond the text and looked at the purpose of it. But even conceding some help or some guidance from the plain text of the statute, Justice Breyer also suggested that even the text itself is not unambiguous. And he honed in on the word any. And so when going back to the text, any patent claim challenged. Does that mean any patent claim challenged by the petitioner in the petition that's filed to institute review? Or does it mean that any patent claim challenged and then it's read in the context of Section 314B, which talks about the threshold of what can of the threshold necessary to actually institute review, and that the director shall determine whether to institute inter partes review or not. And this is where I think the government probably had Well, let me rephrase that. I think that the justices were probably leaning in favor of the government's argument rather than the petitioner's argument as a whole. just because they it seemed like most of the questioning was inclined to read the relevant phrase or the operative phrase in 318A in the broader context. That's from a statutory interpretation, a textualist view. In addition, there are also a series of questions that went to the purpose and the objectives of the whole IPR process and trying to figure out whether the petitioner's argument would lead to a more efficient process or a less efficient process of reviewing patents that might have been erroneously granted by the Patent Office. And I thought on this point, Justice Breyer had a very strong point or analogy or, I guess, hypothetical question, if you will. And he raised the question, and this is in the his context of acknowledging that the statutory text might help petitioners, but he queried whether, even with that language, why would it make sense for the Patent Office to have to issue a final written decision in a case where, for example, only one claim was instituted, or review of one claim was instituted, and nine other claims had been passed on by the board, or where the board said that they did not meet the threshold for review. And so ultimately, I think Justice Breyer, along with Justice Sotomayor and Justice Kagan, they were looking at this this question from a very practical and pragmatic standpoint. And to them, I don't think it made much sense to force the PTO to issue a final written decision when in some instances there may only be one or two claims that are granted review and a whole host of other claims where the board had preliminarily decided that the petition had not met the threshold for granting review. Along those same lines, there was a line of questioning that really emphasized that Congress, in the whole AIA scheme, in the IPR process, had granted the PTO a lot of discretion, in many ways an extraordinary amount of discretion, on whether to review any patents or not. And this goes to directly to the statutory language of 314, for example, where it says the director may not authorize an inter partes review, and then 314A talks about the director shall determine. And what the court, I think, was trying to emphasize, and as well as the Solicitor General's office was trying to emphasize, was that once you get past those four words in 318A, the entire scheme of the AIA grants the Patent Office and the, through the PTAB a lot of discretion on whether to institute review of claims and patents that are challenged by petitioners, whether or not to institute review. And accepting that there's no doubt that there's a lot of an extraordinary amount of discretion granted the Patent Office, it would seem odd that in this one instance that the Patent Office had no discretion, specifically that as long as there was one patent claim that was challenged and then instituted for review, then the Patent Office had no discretion on whether or not it had to issue a final written decision on all of the challenged claims in the petition itself. One additional point I will also mention, Justice Kennedy had several questions that provided insight, again, along the lines of the discretion that was granted to the Patent Office here, and he posed the following hypothetical. He said that, well, what if the Patent Board reviews the petition and say there are 10 claims in the petition that are challenged, and the Patent Board then says, well, we think that review should be instituted for three claims, but not seven, because we have the discretion to deny review in every case. We will deny institution of this petition unless the petitioner refiles a petition and asks to challenge only the three claims that we agree. So what he was essentially hypothesizing was a two-step process that really accomplishes what, or would accomplish, exactly what the one-step process the board does now. And you know, the, again, the SG's, the attorney for the SG's office emphasized this point, and I think this scored a lot of points, if you will, with the court, and underscored a lot of the practical aspects that were being considered by the court with respect to the statutory construction issue. Another point I will add before I could turn it back over to maybe a broader discussion of the two cases is that also considered in the briefing was whether if the statute was ambiguous, whether Chevron deference should be afforded to the Patent Office's interpretation of the statute and the way the Patent Office has implemented its regulations with respect to partial institution and the final written decision on only some of the claims. Overall, in terms of the oral argument today, Chevron was not discussed very much, and I think that's a factor of that. I think most of the court was leaning to affirm in this case, and there was just not very much discussion on whether this particular case could be a vehicle to maybe restrict an agency's application of Chevron to an ambiguous statute. You know, I think we're all well aware of you know, the development in case law as Chevron applies or shouldn't apply to different agency interpretations. I will be surprised in this case if we get an opinion from the court that really delves into that. And so for any of the attorneys who are hoping that or thinking that this case might be one of those vehicles to reassess Chevron, I'd be surprised if it is. And I guess with that, I will maybe turn it back to either Dean or Brian and facilitate some further discussion on the two cases.
Very good. This is Dean Reuter. Thank you both, gentlemen, for outlining those cases, both argued in the Supreme Court this morning. Let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Once again, if you have a question for either of our experts on either of the cases, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got some time left. Let me get things started while we wait to see who might ring in. Brian Pandia on the Oil States case, you mentioned that the advocates, maybe because of the direction from the court, sort of skimmed over some of the larger, more fundamental issues that the case might implicate, whether patents are property on a par with real property or with chattel, and some of the separation of powers arguments, the Seventh Amendment jury trial issue. Those were all included in just a great number of briefs on both sides of the issues. I wonder if you could say more about that. I mean, would they have gotten to those issues in oral argument? Is that your sense, if there was more time? Or did they go by those because the different justices have fixed opinions already? They've decided themselves on that. Do you have any insights there?
Well, thank you, Dean. Again, this is Brian. I think that's an interesting question, and certainly, as I mentioned earlier, the question of whether a patent is private property, like a piece of land or an automobile, or whether it's a public right, like a taxi cab medallion or some other professional license, it's an important question and certainly animates a lot of what is driving this case. But my sense is that even if there was more time, that is not an issue that the court wants to address in this case or plans to address in its opinion in this case. And I have various theories on why that is, but the issue that seemed to animate the court and where I think the opinion will come down on is whether a couple issues, whether there is sufficient Article III supervision of the Patent Trial and Appeal Board. There was a line of questioning that came up dealing with a very arcane procedure called interferences, and that's something that was put into place in the early 1980s through some of the patent legislation of that time, and that procedure still exists for some pre-2011 America Invents Act patents before we switched to from a first-to-invent to first-to-file system, and those proceedings were probably the closest parallel to procedurally the closest parallel to IPRs at the PTAB, in that they were adversarial proceedings before administrative patent judges rather than before patent examiners like ex parte reexamination or the previous inter partes reexamination proceedings. The former, which oil states conceded would be constitutionally permissible, and the latter, which didn't give a clear answer, but conceded would be a closer case and probably okay under Article III. But to turn back to the point of judicial supervision, there was a line of questioning about interferences, and which was something that existed for 40 years and are wrapping up now. But the one unique thing about an interference compared to PTAB proceedings is that with an interference, there were two routes of appeal. One, you could appeal to the district court and create a new factual record. It would be effectively starting from scratch, not unlike an appeal of a bankruptcy court proceeding, an appeal of a magistrate judge's report and recommendation, an appeal from a Social Security Administration ALJ determination, or you could appeal. Second appeal, right, would be with the you could appeal directly to the Federal Circuit. The issues you could appeal were more circumscribed based on the record below. You couldn't make a new record, but you had much greater Article III supervision. I think that point was something that the court was really focused on. And the second point, as I mentioned earlier, was the question of line drawing, whether, at least based on some questions from Justice Ginsburg, whether this was a narrow proceeding limited to addressing whether, in the first instance, the Patent Office made a mistake in issuing a patent, and whether they can only look back in an IPR proceeding, you can only look at certain grounds for patentability, primarily prior art, Section 102, whether a patent's anticipated, Section 103, whether a patent's obvious. You cannot raise a Section 101 patentability, a Section 101 patentable subject matter challenge in the context of an IPR. There are other invalidity defenses that are available in district court that cannot be raised at the PTAB. So I think that the court was more focused on where does this line fall rather than wanting to get into the bigger and broader question of whether a patent is a piece of private property, in which case I don't think there would be any question that the PTAB is not constitutional. And somewhat interestingly, Justice Gorsuch, near the end of the argument from counsel for oil states, actually pushed oil states counsel to say why aren't all patents private property, and if that's the case, isn't any adjudication by an agency unconstitutional? So I think he did want to go to the broader question. That question, though, followed a question from Justice Breyer, who said that something along the lines of that all sorts of agencies decide adjudicatory matters. So if they come out, if the Supreme Court in this case says an agency cannot adjudicate a dispute over a patent, doesn't that call into question everything from the from adjudications at the FCC to the FTC to the SEC? We can go through the whole alphabet soup of agencies that he mentioned. And I think the FCC point was a subtle reference to the 2013 case, FCC versus Arlington, where I believe that was a case by Justice Scalia, where he was in the majority joined by Justice Thomas, Justices Sotomayor, Ginsburg, Kagan, and Breyer. But there was a strong dissent in that case, authored by, I think, Justice Kennedy, joined by the Chief Justice and Justice Alito, who really began the debate on a lot of these questions about what an agency can do to adjudicate effectively a dispute between private parties. So I don't think the court will get into the question of whether a patent is private property. As you said, Dean, a lot of their views are fixed on that issue, and
that was just the Chief Justice who sort of was veering in that direction, which you mentioned.
Yeah, okay, well, thanks for that clarification. So,
let me ask then. We do have one caller question, but your reaction there brings up at least two questions in my mind. One is. It feels to me that, explain to me where I'm going wrong here, that the level of supervision required by an Article III court would be, it seems, directly related to whether or not patents are property. So no level of supervision is going to be adequate if patents are property. And then the second question is about the relationship, and I think you were getting there with City of Arlington, the relationship of this judicial supervision, Article III supervision of the PTAB, and the interaction with Chevron. How important is judicial deference in the exercise of Article III supervision? How do those things interact?
Well, let me take your second point, and that actually raises one of the more interesting comments that I may have glossed over in my earlier remarks. When Malcolm Stewart from the Solicitor General's office was giving his remarks on behalf of the government respondents, he actually noted that when you're in district court, the burden of invalidating a patent is by clear and convincing evidence, while the PTAB. It's a much lower standard of preponderance of the evidence, substantial question of patentability, and he actually turned that around and said that's a feature, not a bug of the system, and he tried to tie that back to the point that what the PTAB is doing here is very narrow. It's an error correction mechanism. It's not a dispute between two parties, even though there's a petitioner and a respondent at the PTAB. Effectively, it's just that the petitioner is the party that's in effect doing the work of the government or the work of the PTO in pointing out these flaws in patents that were issued and letting the patent office reconsider whether to grant a patent. Now, on your first question, Dean, about the level of judicial supervision. I would agree with you that if they came out and said a patent's clearly a private right, then there's probably no amount of judicial supervision that would cure what Oil States has alleged are the deficiencies with the PTAB. But I don't think the Supreme Court needs to go there. One of the questions I think where this case is going to end up being decided on is the narrowness or the breadth of IPR proceedings and other proceedings at the Patent Trial and Appeal Board. Oil States conceded that something like ex parte reexamination, where you have a petition filed by a member of the public, by a third party, but the entire process then is a negotiation between the patent owner and the patent examiner with a lot of latitude to amend claims, effectively reopening patent examination would be okay. That's an examinational proceeding. The complaint that Oil States focused in on at argument was this looks too much like an adjudication proceedings. And there's the cases, I think the walks like a duck, quacks like a duck line of cases that the court has occasionally pulled out that line of thought or that type of reasoning when looking at whether whether something is more like an Article III adjudicative proceeding or something in agency action. I think it will come down to whether the court views the fact that you have discovery in limited discovery, but you have discovery in PTAB proceedings. You have a panel of administrative patent judges rather than a patent examiner. You have two private parties in the case. You have the petitioner with the burden of proof that has to be met, and whether a proceeding with all those characteristics, on one hand, on the other hand, you have very limited appellate review of PTAB proceedings. Whether that is is too much, and that is likely to be where the case is going to be decided. Hey, Dean,
Matthew Dowd, do you have a point on this?
Sure, yeah. I'd like to add one point on this as well, too. And I think that with respect to the property right issue or the private versus public right issue, you know, I thought Malcolm Stewart did a very good job of trying to explain differences between when a particular so-called private right had to be adjudicated before an Article III court versus when it could be adjudicated versus in an Article I agency. And I think the court found that attractive, and basically the argument went along the lines of, well, if it's not a private right, if it's not a dispute between two private parties, in which one party will then be found liable for some sort of money damages, then it's not the type of dispute that has to be adjudicated in an Article III court. And if you look at, for example, the Stern case and bankruptcy courts, you know, that falls in line with the Solicitor General's argument. And you can also apply that and distinguish those cases from what the court was addressing here, where ultimately the Patent Trial and Appeal Board is not at least directly deciding a party's liability for infringement. The board is deciding the validity of the patent itself or the claims itself. And now, of course, that does indirectly affect whether a party will be liable for patent infringement, but yeah, I think the court found the argument attractive and cogent, and I would not be surprised to see the court adopt, at least in part, that reasoning.
Yeah, and this is Brian. If I can just piggyback on those comments, it's one of the more interesting exchanges, again, came at the end of the argument in Oil States, and where I think it was Justice Sotomayor asked Malcolm Stewart whether Congress could permit the PTAB or the Patent Office to adjudicate disputes over infringement. And I think the answer that for different reasons, that question came up in several forms, I think from Justice Sotomayor, Justice Gorsuch, maybe it was Justice Alito or Justice Kagan. I don't recall who asked that question, other than the side of the bench from which it came from. But I think they were actually hoping, or for various reasons, that Mr. Stewart would say, actually, yes, the court could, in limited circumstances, permit the Patent Office to give an advisory opinion on infringement. One example that immediately comes to mind would be in the case of a Hatch-Waxman Act dispute, where it's a declaratory judgment, there's no monetary damages at stake, just a question of whether one party's actions will infringe a patent. And he said no and gave two reasons, that there's no history of doing that, and these are private disputes, which coincidentally open the door to a question, I think, about the Privy Council and whether, which was a body in England that existed in the 1600s and 1700s to revoke patents. So that was one interesting, but I thought underdeveloped line of questioning that the court touched upon. Another, one of the more humorous comments from Justice Gorsuch, and this was near the end of the argument, he took this to be a tongue-in-cheek comment, but he said that the tradition of the Patent Office reviewing patents is more than 40 years old, referring to interferences, and less than 400 years old, referring to the Privy Council, which, according to the petitioner, last revoked a patent in 1789.
We seem to have lost our caller who had a question. If you'd like to ask a question, our lines are wide open. Just push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We do have a question, so let's head in the direction of this caller now, if we could.
Hello, this is Nicholas Chidiak from Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney. I wanted to ask, it sounded like there wasn't much discussion of how PTAB panels are formed and some of the issues. Some objections have been raised about how the panels can be put together by the agency, presumably directed towards certain results. Is there any discussion of that? Are there any issues about the way PTAB itself is administered?
Thank you, Nick, for the question. This is Brian, and then I'm sure Matt will chime in. There was a question directed to Malcolm Stewart from the Solicitor General's office about the handful of recent instances where the director of the patent office or the chief judge of the PTAB expanded a panel, depending on who you ask. Some people say it was to change the outcome of a case. Other people say that it was just to, in effect, be an en banc determination that would provide guidance both to the public and other panels about how the PTAB plans should address issues. So there was a question about it. I think that the upshot was that this was a rare occurrence. It was on a procedural question that is dealing with the institution decision, not the merits of a patentability determination. But it was something that I think interested the court, but there was not a whole lot of discussion about the constitution of panels and whether that is something that gives pause.
Hi, this is Matthew Dowd. Like Brian said, there were several questions about it. I think Chief Justice Roberts brought that up, was the first to bring it up. I do think that it's something that bothered Chief Justice Roberts and probably several other of the justices. Ultimately, though, I think it's an issue, and if I remember correctly, some of the answers went along this lines, that to the extent that is a problem, to the extent that the board or the PTO director shuffling around judges who are on panels, to the extent that's a problem, the SG's response was that it could be an issue that's raised as an APA claim, for example, where it's an arbitrary, capricious act of the agency, or it could be a due process claim based on the facts of that case. So I don't think at least, I'll rephrase it. I think that there were several justices who were bothered by that, and if I remember correctly, that was a point that was raised particularly in the reply brief, in the merits stage briefing. And I think it scored some points, if you will, with the court. Well, I don't think it will change the outcome of the case. You might see some language and opinion that references it or maybe warns the agency about it. I think it will trouble the court to see the agency acting in such a manner. But ultimately, if there is any recourse, assuming it is a problem that may brush up against the boundaries of the agency's authority, then I think what the court was suggesting, at least during oral argument today, is that there are other possible routes to get a remedy, but it's not necessarily a constitutional violation.
We do have another caller with a question, so let's now check in with a second caller here.
It seems to me that there is kind of an opinion in the decision as to whether or not to institute the review of certain claims that it finds are that needn't review. And it may be a little bit cursory, but just to the point of saying that prior art uncovered by the petitioner doesn't impugn these claims, and they're still valid. So I don't know that is without a decision by the board.
Yeah, hi, this is Matthew Dowd. Thanks for the question and the comment. And I agree with you to some extent. And your point was actually discussed during our argument today. And so for the petitioner, Greg Castanius was making this point, and I think he made it during rebuttal primarily because the attorney for the SG tried to suggest that, at least perhaps also during briefing, but today during argument, that there are many other reasons why that initial decision to deny institution might not be a merits-based reason. But I think if you practice before the board, it sounds like you do, and many other attorneys probably do on the call, you know that many times the board, when it makes that initial institution decision, it really is making a decision often on the merits of the unpatentability or invalidity arguments that are presented. Now, to be fair, I think SG's office did, Jonathan Bond, he did mention several other instances where there may be a reason or an example where the board denies review for a reason that would not be the subject of a final written decision on the merits of those claims. So, for example, in the IPR process, if a petition came in, challenged certain claims as unpatentable under 112, for example, right? So the board would have to deny institution on that. And the court picked up on this and said or thought that, well, it wouldn't make any sense for the board to then have to write a final written decision on those claims that were denied a review because the initial challenge was for a reason that cannot be reviewed under IPR. The other point that was made, and this goes to the merits analysis, is that even if the initial decision is somewhat or at least cursorily on the merits, then it's not, those claims aren't adjudicated during the whole, the complete trial process, the so-called trial process of the proceeding. So I think that there is some merit to your point, and but the government also had a valid response. So I think it will be very interesting to see how the court incorporates that aspect into the opinion.
Looks like we've run out of time just about, and we've run out of questions. Let me give each of you 60 seconds to wrap up, and as you do so, maybe you would give us a sense, to the extent you can, when you think each of these respective cases would be decided. I'm not sure the oil states case or the SAS case goes to the last day of term, but I'm interested in your thoughts on that. Why don't we go in the order we started let's go Brian Pandya first, if we could, Brian.
Okay. Thank you, Dean, and thanks to everyone on the call and the questions we received. I do think this case is going to take the court a bit of time to sort out. Oil states is going to it's going to take a little bit of while, and certainly I don't see this being a last day of the term type of case. But I think given the intensity of the questioning and the divergent questioning, this is going to be a case that's going to take a little bit of while to sort out, and there will be multiple opinions is my prediction of this case. You know, I think one challenge that the petitioner faces here is that I think there were a number of legitimate questions raised about the Patent Trial and Appeal Board, but one difficulty the petitioner faces here is that is there a way to get to 5 votes? I can certainly count a way to get to 3 or 4 votes on any number of the issues that were raised, whether it be the narrowness or the breadth of PTAB proceedings, the more fundamental question whether this is a public right or private property, the level of Article III supervision, and so forth. But whether there are 5 people sign on to that I could be challenging. Now, if you're looking at this from the side of the respondent or the side of the government, I would be a little bit paused by the number of concerns that were raised, and except for maybe a few questions from Justice Breyer and Justice Ginsburg, that there was not a full-throated defense of the Patent Trial and Appeal Board and the nature and way in which these proceedings are conducted.
Final thought from Matthew Down.
All right. Thank you, Dean. Thanks, everyone, for joining us today. I will be quick and short because I do think that the court will provide a quick and short decision in SAS Institute. It may not be unanimous. It seemed to me that Justice Alito was, of all the justices asking questions during the second case today, he was probably leaning most strongly with the petitioner, but nonetheless, I think the weight of the court is leaning towards affirming the Federal Circuit and then ruling in favor of the PTO or the agency in SAS Institute. And I will leave it on this as a former clerk for Chief Judge Michelle, now retired of the Federal Circuit. I will say that my prediction is that this is a rare instance where the Supreme Court will affirm the Federal Circuit in 2 cases on a single day. And I can't recall the last time that has happened.
Fascinating. Well, thank you both for joining us. And, of course, thank you for your time in attending oral argument and then digesting things and giving us your readout. We certainly appreciate it. Thanks to the audience as well for dialing in and for your thoughtful questions. A reminder to our audience about our next scheduled Teleforum conference call is tomorrow at 3 p.m. We'll be talking about the Digital Reality Trust versus Summers case. That's a securities whistleblower case, looking at the question of whether the whistleblower needs to alert the SEC or whether or not they can just report up the company ladder and get protection. And also a reminder to check your emails for other scheduled Teleforum conference calls. We might have one in the very near future, not yet scheduled, on the CFPB directorship. But until that next Teleforum conference call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.